Hey, wonderfuls. Welcome to episode 333 of the JV Club with my more or less boy of summer, Mr. Neil Patrick Harris. I say more or less because this is actually a recording, an audio recording of the live tribute to Neil that we did at SF Sketchfest back in January. And so one thing that you will find absent certainly is the MASH game. I have every intention of catching up with Neil and getting a chance to sort of play that with him, because I think he would love it as much as I love doing it. So that is on my agenda, but I thought it was a really fun afternoon, and I wanted to be able to share that with you. So I hope you enjoy it as we consider him one of our very special boys of summer. You will, of course, also not hear him sing Don Henley's Boys of Summer. But you know what? If you need to hear him sing something, treat yourself and just do a Google search of any number of things that you can find Neil singing in, because he's a wonderful, wonderful singer, as you probably we already know. Alrighty, I will talk to you guys soon. Hope everyone's having a great summer. Folks, please put your hands together for Mr. Neil Patrick Harris.
Hi, everybody.
Oh,
that
my
was
goodness.
So cool. Thank you. That was very professional and so cool.
I just want to say that our technical sort of director of the entire festival, Heather Gallagher, put that together in addition to managing like 300 shows. So I was dazzled and impressed and excited.
Is that the same Heather that picked me up at the airport?
Different Heather.
Oh, okay. She was nice.
I will say, there was a time at SF Sketchfest where it absolutely would have been the same Heather.
Yeah.
Or just would have been me.
It's exciting to be here at the Sketch of the Fest. At the last of it, though, is fun because all of you guys are kind of bleary.
Yeah. Yeah. We sort of move in a sort of jelly-like manner.
A little glazed.
If jelly could get tired. Blah, blah, blah.
I think of jelly as tired. I don't think of jelly as super attentive.
Oh, you do? I guess that's true.
Like,
Well, it knows it's about to be eaten, so I don't know how. It's either going to panic or just kind of allow it to happen.
Like my sex life.
And that's jelly, everyone.
But I'm very proud of you. The fact that you three, but you know, I know you personally, have spent so much of your time giving back to the town where you once lived, and it is a beast, a juggernaut every year to put all of these things together. For every evening, there's multiple shows with multiple people, and all of those people have to have flights and have to have rooms, and there's complications.
Yes, they do.
No, it's just a very impressive thing that you do it.
Yeah,
in addition
buddy,
to
you
all of your acting and all of the other things you do. I'm being effusive, but it's,
I think what's
it's
happening
great.
Is you're hosting this right now.
Yeah, so that
he went right into it. He was like, and I'm hosting. Yeah, I guess
I don't
I'm okay
think
with that.
That these people appreciate just how hard it is to do what you do.
Neil, I couldn't possibly.
There she is.
Well, I'm so glad that you came back. You've been to the festival in the past. You and I both have terrible memories because we do too much.
Yeah.
So I was actually trying to remember exactly which one it was.
The last time I think I was, yeah. I interviewed Brian Henson.
You interviewed Brian Henson? A different year that you did the Thrilling Adventure Hour, I
Correct.
Think. Correct. Which was also a different year than the year you almost came, and then you had to shoot the Muppets. I think you had to shoot the Muppets.
Yeah.
And then you sent... This is a very classy person. First of all, he hates making a commitment and then not being able to fulfill that commitment.
True that.
And he avoids it at all costs. And in this particular situation, he absolutely did have to do it because it was a very large group. I think it was the group scene, right? Where you're part of the kind of the telethon
yep.
in the Muppets. And they just needed him when they needed him. And I am the last person who's going to say, like, Muppet Schmuppets. although that was pretty fun to say. And
it's
so
good to be
he
back.
Said, yeah. He and so instead of saying, like, I'm so sorry, guys, best of luck to you, he said, I'm working on finding you some kind of replacement. And he sent Jason Segel instead. It's just like, We'll take him. That's great. Yeah. So
who was oddly not doing the Muppets
that
day.
I know, isn't that weird? It actually is really weird.
Yeah.
Because I don't even know if I put those two things together at the time.
Yeah,
maybe he was like, yeah. But you got to do the Muppets. That's a pretty big deal.
Muppets are amazing. Puppets are amazing. The whole... My two idols growing up were Jim Henson and Walt Disney.
Yeah.
So... Now I've gotten to go and play at the Disney theme parks and go backstage, and I'm just such a geek about that kind of stuff.
I'm so glad you still are.
I love animatronics and pneumatics and how it works. I like how things work.
Yeah.
Right now, it's like my brain. I like escape rooms. You know?
Like escape rooms? Well, that's, and that's magic as well.
Magic.
Right? Because you, and this actually, by the way, we're going to be all over the place.
Yeah.
I have a lot of note cards. But if I were to just go completely autobiographically in terms of like, Neo, why don't you tell us about this now? Why don't you tell us about 2002 now? I would say, by the way, if you're interested in a very, very fun autobiography, you should read Neil's because it's a choose-your-own-adventure autobiography. He dies in it so many times. I'm not a person who asks, like, what was your favorite? So I'm not going to ask him what his favorite death was. But secretly, I wonder if there were, like, a bunch of deaths on the cutting room floor, as it were. Like, nah, I don't know. Suffocated by licorice twists didn't make it. It just didn't quite.
We had 5 or 6 really good deaths in it, and then we thought it was funny that you just kept dying the same way in the past. Yes, I was.
Yeah,
I like the choose your own adventure idea.
Yeah.
I was an early Bandersnatcher.
I was... Please, I was going to say, you absolutely
have you
preempted.
Done Bandersnatch?
I have done Bandersnatch.
I've only done it once.
You know,
so the
Netflix...
Netflix, Black Mirror, Charlie Brooker has the new thing. It's Bandersnatch, and it's a choose-your-own-adventure Black Mirror episode that can only be done in 2019
with
very heavy bandwidth,
smart,
right?
You know, yeah.
Can you do it in at home by clicking on the TV?
You can do it at home. You can do it on your computer. But it has to be something that you can kind of click and respond to. So you can't do it. I thought I could do it on my Apple TV. Actually, let's just get a guy from Netflix out here. Could you come out here and explain?
No, but I love that technology and the idea of making the technology that allows multiple bandwidth thing. What's it called when it's uploading?
To have all of those various, like the breadth and, yeah, we're not, I mean.
Buffering.
Thank you.
Put up,
thank
buffer,
you for that
buddy.
Complicated never before heard term. Buffering, huh?
Yeah, that's a good word.
Interesting. I got to remember that one.
Not too hard to remember.
Yeah. I was fascinated by the different. Like they actually sort of started sharing the statistics on who chooses what.
And
I was so excited and proud that that my sweetie and I chose like the rarest. Like we ended up on one of the rarer courses. We're like, oh. It's like finding out anything. Like what's your astrological sign?
Gemini.
Lucky. Like, it could be just any, like, oh, I got it. So there's a couple, like, you can sort of feel lucky, but yeah, you can sort of make yourself feel special about anything if you set your mind to it, but.
I just like the idea of content being anti-structure.
Yeah.
And I don't know that that's necessarily anti-structure, but it just changes the way you watch stuff, right?
Absolutely.
So that's why the Choose Your Own Autobiography was that way if you wanted to know all about Barney Stinson-y stories and Harold and Kumar-y stuff, you could do that.
Yeah.
But if you were, like, super into the gay stuff...
Or just...
You just don't go to that
dying.
Page.
If you're just real into Neil dying. So many opportunities, but then just the one opportunity over and over. No, but that is very you, and that's one of the things about you that that I think is kind of wonderful, is that you are sort of that also, which is to say you are one of the most sort of diversely talented but also interested in so many different things people that I know, that it makes sense to me that every new thing you do is both a surprise and also like, oh, of course. Like, of course Neil is producing immersive theater. Of course he's a magician. Of course he's, you know, dancing and doing the most complicated stuff out there on television with, you know, casts of all of the Broadway musicals at once. There's a sense of, I was about to say joie de vivre. Oh, gosh. Am I really going to start throwing around terms like that?
It's like a ferocity. I don't know.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Like a voraciousness that I'm trying to quell a little bit.
But I think that's great because that it's. I think it is encouraging to anyone to sort of go, well, if there's this other thing, like if you sort of identify yourself as like, I'm just this kind of person, then you're not leaving yourself open to the opportunities, the choose your own adventures, if you will, of these other things that you can find exciting. And I think your enthusiasm for them is what ends up tying it all together and why it makes sense, why each thing kind of makes sense to me.
I think that it's a good tenet in life to not just be complacent and work on a singular thing that you know how to do well, but I think it's important to try and learn new skill sets. And as an actor, I'm in a very unique and exciting place where we get to do that. From job to job, you're meeting new people, you're having to sort of reinvent yourself as a character, but even within that little world, and it might have been from having done Doogie Howser when I was young, right? That was 16 to 19.
Pause for our cheers.
Oh, thanks. He was so sexy. It's so weird to see and watch clips of myself
when I'm talking like this and I...
like mainlining Accutane because my face is just broken out.
Oh, that was... I mean, listen, you survived Accutane. That in and of itself is an achievement.
But I think maybe having done television and having that name... being so recognized by such a recognizable name that wasn't my actual name, then I was interested in not shedding that, but in doing something, proving myself in a different way.
Sure.
So it was sort of in two reasons, right? I wanted to not just be known as a TV actor person, because there's lots of other opportunity. That opportunity came to me in a really fortuitous way, and so I wanted to be able to show that I had skills to do other things, but I also just like to learn to do other things. I see people who are just afraid to sing karaoke or afraid to dance or afraid to do stuff that might be flop sweaty. And I think that flop sweaty, that feeling is uncomfortable, but inconsequential.
Mm.
You know, it's of consequence to you when it's happening, but then, well, like I did an improv set at the Speakeasy two nights ago, and I was the monologist, and you're supposed to come out there and just talk, and then the amazing improvisers do long form about what you said, and I was so nervous because I didn't know what I had. You're not supposed to tell stories; you're supposed to get suggestions and just free associate. I was so nervous. I mean, like actively sweaty, nervous about
it. Which sounds like celebratory. I loved how nervous you were.
But then it went well. It was fun because even if I fumbled, which I did, they got to use that as part of the fodder. But at the end of it, we were performing downstairs in a speakeasy comedy club in a town in the middle of America, right?
Yeah.
So it's not of great consequence, and yet I was really nervous and freaked out about it. So I think it's important to do as many skill sets, challenges as you can.
Absolutely.
To travel to places, to just have your bucket list be full.
Does your, because I absolutely associate all of that with the sort of, the live nature of doing the Tonys or, doing live theater.
Mm.
Obviously, when you're doing something like Hedwig, you're doing essentially the same show over and over, but it's also a live atmosphere where things can happen and do, and audiences are different, and so the energy is different. Does that rush of adrenaline that you get from those moments, do you experience that? Are you also the person who goes skydiving, is I guess my question. Do you find that you thirst for those kinds of exciting experiences outside, or is it fulfilled by those things that you do in entertainment?
Oh, I definitely like to skydive and to do crazy stuff physically. I think that while my hips are still okay, I should challenge them. So I like the physical stuff. Yeah, I guess I'm a bit of a thrill seeker in that way.
Well, we've got a surprise for you because we're going to be amazing.
Silks?
Up into the air.
The silk act that we won.
Yeah.
I don't know what the question was.
Because I interrupted you by just stating something that couldn't be answered as a question. And then I interrupted even that to say that we had some sort of daredevil stunt for you.
I loved and have gotten recently to do
challenge myself, and I did a variety show for NBC for a season called Best Time Ever, and apparently it wasn't. But it was live.
Ambitious.
It was live, live, live. It wasn't live to tape and then edited down. And there was a thing called the end of the show show, and every week we'd do something crazy different. So yeah, I was breathing fire and doing backflips off of pneumatic pogo sticks and the tramp wall. I did all kinds of crazy things. And I'm not quite sure. I was just interested in challenging myself and seeing what I could do and how it would go. And maybe from the Tony Award adrenaline, that was kind of fun. But it's a grueling. It's nice to... I like this series of unfortunate emptiness. I like being able to make art in addition to the fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants, hope it all goes well one-offs.
Sure. When was the first time, or roughly the first time, I'm trying to remember from... I didn't see a lot of Doogie Howser, I'm so sorry. Maybe when we do the audience Q&A later, that exchange can happen. I can find out more. Maybe someone else has the answer to this, too. But
what would be your question?
Thematically, again, maybe am I not ever going to ask a question? Sure. Were there episodes on Doogie Howser where you would suddenly like in your fantasy, you're an old man, or you're, you know, was there special effects kind of makeup stuff happening as early as that in your career?
Oh, special effects stuff. That was 89 to 92, so the prosthetic technology wasn't as advanced as it is now. I think there was an episode where someone had a rhinoplasty, so she had a bigger nose and then got that, but that wasn't me.
That wasn't you transforming
no.
in some way.
It was really an Honor Your Mother, I think, when I did Old Man Barney and Large Barney, we were able to do that.
How did you react to being transformed in that way?
It was fun. Those were trickier because you didn't have much time to get used to it, because on a situation comedy, you know, you have to make the days, and it's very quick. So I was just, I had half an hour or something. But doing Olaf, and that was fun. And again, I was like, thanks. That was like, I was wanting to challenge myself with that. I always wondered when I watched Star Trek and things, the people whose character required all that makeup, what it felt like to move your face within, when it's hidden by something else, right? How much adhesive is on there? How subtle can you be? And the technologies are pretty impressive now, so, but it is just a lot of glue all over your face.
Yeah.
And every bubble, you know, they have to. You could see it. So it was a very time labored.
Sure.
Laboring time of time.
I think we actually have like a little snippet from a series of unfortunate events, just to kind of look at and get a sense.
Do you really
some
right
of
now?
Those prosthetics.
Or is this a joke?
No.
Oh wow, is this
it's
so cool?
Not. Maybe we could take a look, because I think even in this clip, you see some transformation.
Is in my blood. It's what I know. It's how I live my life.
I am Count Olaf, the renowned actor.
I'm one of perhaps the greatest actors to have graced the boards, and I find it sad and deplorable that more people haven't seen me in all of my grandeur, but there's still hope. For myself, acting is an internal combustion of personal enjoyment. It does not provide much in the way of finances. It does allow me to pilfer many of my wardrobe items. This was from a one-man show I did in 2003. What a wonderful question you've come up with. I would say, Count Olaf, obviously. I would probably say Stefano, which was the character I played for a small time. Very believable.
Third on Mount Rushmore, Shirley St. Ives.
I'm Dr. Orwell's receptionist. My name is Shirley.
Shockingly, another character I played myself. And last on my list, Olaf, Stefano, Shirley, and Malcolm Jamal Warner.
Okay.
That's good.
That was a behind. Obviously, that was a little behind the scenes. But there were so many other little wonderful characters buried inside there.
I just thought it was fun. You really had to, in order to make a surprised expression as Olaf, you had to go bigger than that. So it was weird acting. Olaf was super fun, but oddly complicated, because every episode he dons a disguise, but it wasn't Neil playing a different character, it was Olaf playing a different character, and Olaf's a terrible actor. So I had to do a different thing, a different voice, a different physicality, but it had to be bad enough that Olaf would be doing it, and I had to kind of flip from one to the other. And then they kept adding new ones, so I had to keep finding new voices and new inflections, but still be Olaf and be obvious enough that the kids could see, but subtle enough that adults couldn't, and then hopefully an audience didn't just think it was just terrible acting across the board. So, but that was fun. Barry Sonnenfeld is unbelievable.
Yeah.
He's... That show, I read people say that it sort of looks like a Wes Anderson film. Mm-hmm. And I think it's Wes Anderson owes a lot to Barry Sonnenfeld's imagery. He's just really good with cameras and lenses. I mean, he was the DP for the Coen brothers, did Blood Simple. Mm-hmm. But it was fun to be able to do that kind of content for families, a Netflix expensive show. And have it be so artistic.
Yeah.
And not have it just... I don't know, I feel like a lot of times content for teenagers or middle grade kids is just not treated very respectfully.
Yeah.
And I get it, because a lot of the movies suck. But, like, you know, Alvin and the Chipmunks was good, and then there's like five of them. I've done a couple Smurfs.
Now, when you say you've done a couple Smurfs...
I had sex with them.
Okay. Great. In describing your appreciation of the actual...
There's just so many jokes.
Yeah, we can take some more time.
No.
In the way you're describing the sort of ambiance and how
I went to Blue Balls. I went first to Blue Balls, and then like Oh Papa. I went to like an Oh Papa place. I was trying to swing it back to Smurfette. Then it all felt like kind of rapey, and I didn't want to go there.
I can't imagine why.
Okay, we're back.
Okay, cool. No, I mean, listen, we can talk about the Smurfs for the rest of the time together if you guys want to talk about the Smurfs. More. Got some...
Please, no. Oh, hi. You're here. Sorry.
Some Smurfers. Is there... We got to come up with a name for people who really love the Smurfs.
Apologies.
There you go. Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a break. I will be back after a word from our wonderful buddies at Maximum Fun.
Hi, I'm Joe Firestone.
And I'm Manolo Moreno.
And we're the hosts of Dr. Game Show, which is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, regardless of quality or content, with in-studio guests and callers from all over the world.
And you can win a custom magnet.
A custom magnet.
Subscribe now to make sure you get our next episode.
What's an example of a game, Manolo?
Pokemon or medication.
How do you play that?
You have to guess if something's a Pokemon name or medication.
Medication.
First time listener, if you want to listen to episode highlights and also know how to participate, follow Dr. Game Show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
We'd love to hear
from
you.
It's really fun.
For the whole family, we'll be every other Wednesday starting March 13th, and we're coming to Max Fun!
Snorlax.
Pokemon?
Yes.
Nice.
Aesthetics of a series of unfortunate events and Barry Sonnenfeld, that's something that you pay attention to, and you've paid attention to for a long time. When was the first time you really sort of started to say, and was it early as Doogie, can I just take a look behind the, can I see what you're, you know, because...
I just love the process,
yeah.
Janet. I really do. I love the process. I love the first thing I ever did in earnest was a movie called Clara's Heart with opposite Whoopi Goldberg, and I filmed it in Baltimore, Maryland, and it was just so cool to see it all, to see what the camera looks like and the dolly track and the tape marks that you're supposed to hit without looking down and these big lights, and I don't know, I just found that all so fascinating that it takes this village of skilled professionals to put something together to make it happen. And then when I would go see Broadway shows in New York, I was I liked the show, but I was equally excited by where the sets go and how the turntable works and like the process of it all. The process of rehearsing a play is so fun because it's just the actors in a room and the director and choreographer person, that's it. And you try it all a bunch of different, I know the process of it all is very intriguing to me. So when you have a director who's adept at what he or she is doing, and then you have a crew that thrives on that, David Fincher is a really great director, and it makes such a difference. The crew is so interested in his responses, and you're working on making something exciting. I don't know. I get off on everyone feeling honored, you know, within a process. I think sometimes the actors asked to be very myopic and only think about their character, and they're often just held in the dressing room or
the pen,
a wagon or something until it's time, and then at night they knock on your door and they come and they walk you and you do this scene, they take you back, and it's a little isolating. I don't know. I guess that speaks to a lot of the things that I have done and continue to do. Hedwig was fun because she never left the stage, and it was always kind of different. She got to mess around with people in the audience, so there was a unique factor to that. We all had to be working hard. The Tony stuff was fun because it's a night that you get to honor and all these people that work so hard 8 times a week. You think about those ensemble dancers in those Broadway shows. They don't get paid a lot of money.
Yeah.
I mean, they make a living, but it's relatively paycheck to paycheck. And they're the ones that have 6 different characters, quick changes. They have to warm up before, physical therapy afterward. They're kicking like crazy. They're just really impressive and not well known. So once a year, you get to go and watch TV. And a lot of people only get to see the Broadway shows when they see the Tonys.
Yeah.
And it's a great P.T. Barnum moment to say, hi, everyone, thanks. Instead of 1,000 people here, there's now 1 million people. Watch these people. They're amazing. And then watch these people. They're amazing. I think that's, in many ways, more of an exciting award show experience at home than the Oscars or the Emmys, where you don't have a lot of things to watch.
Yeah.
Lists of people being thanked is appropriate. That's the design of the award show.
Right.
But I think the Tonys allowed us to get a really great opportunity to be proud of your friends.
That makes a ton of sense. I had so many thoughts when you were speaking. One of the thoughts was, again, kind of returning to the idea of you being both enthralled by something and loving, not knowing the mystery behind how it all happens. And then perhaps immediately followed by or concurrently going, I gotta know how that works. How does that work? So that's magic, right, as well. Did you feel that way from the start? The first trick you saw
with
was
magic.
Just like, I need to be behind the scenes on this, whatever that is.
Yeah, kind of. I did just think magic's a super cool hobby. There was
like
a magic
like a
shop.
Chicken boy magnet hobby. Totally kidding. You've made those jokes before.
Chicken boy magnet?
Yeah, like, hey, ladies, I like magic tricks.
Hey,
I'm 12.
You want to want to play with my wand?
That's right. That's right.
No, I grew up in small town New Mexico, and we would drive up to Albuquerque.
Pause for Albuquerque and New Mexico.
I think that was for small town New Mexico.
Yeah.
It was called Ruidoso.
Ruidoso.
It's the name of the town I grew up in.
I'm from Tucson, of course, Arizona.
From Tucson.
Arizona. Mm-hmm.
Arizona.
Yeah.
I always wonder.
I always feel that Tucson and Albuquerque are cousins. Like they're sort
they're
of, they
close.
Have the sort of same, people are either like, oh, I love, you know, Southern New Mexico, or I love Tucson, I love Arizona, or they're like, hmm.
I'm very much in the former camp.
Yeah,
but
that's good.
But in Ruidoso was tiny. There was not much of anything. You'd have to drive to Alamogordo to go to a mall. And so in Albuquerque was a magic shop called called Fool's Paradise.
Fool's Paradise, yeah.
It was rad. And then what a great thing for a kid to do, to save your allowance. I would save up my allowance, and I would go, and you'd see this glass case with all the shelves of different tricks, and you could ask him, the magician behind the desk, to show you tricks, and he'd show you tricks all day long. But you just didn't know how they were done until you paid for them.
Right.
So it was just... yeah. It was very... I needed to know how they were done. And in turn, then I would buy three small packet tricks. And then on the ride, the 3 hours ride home, I would be able to open up and see the effect and the method.
Ah, the method.
And see how it's done and then practice it to myself. So magic in just in execution is a fun thing. But then when you start learning about the histories of magic and you start learning about stage illusion versus car manipulation, it's very inspiring. I don't know. It's got a great depth of history to it. And just theatrically, I think it's really cool. Misdirection, black art, all of that stuff I think is really is aligned with my interests.
Well, that's another place where we, I think, really see you celebrating other people, other artists, you know, having a kind of camaraderie and community with people. Not just, I feel like that's absolutely present with the Tonys.
Hmm.
It's present in the sort of your appreciation of magic and your producing other people's, you know, sort of like ushering forth lesser known artists and saying, how can I help? How can I help share what I'm impressed by with everybody? Because when you are excited by something, you absolutely are not the person who goes, that guy's better than me. I gotta just, I don't want anybody to know about this. It's quite the opposite. It's here's who I think is the best of their kind, or, you know, certainly doing something unusual and unique. And
I guess
I think
so.
That's
as you say
that.
They that though, I feel, I don't know. I feel like I've always, because I was from a small town in New Mexico and kind of came. Oh, there they are again. They're back.
That
like
might
pigeons.
Just be a tick. Like, if you hear it, you've been... that person was formerly hypnotized, so now every time they go to a small town in New Mexico, they're like, ah! They don't know they're doing it. It's okay.
I think I've always felt a little bit like I was the outsider needing to prove something, which is odd because I've done a lot of things. And I'm 45 years old, and I still often feel like I'm having to... fake it a little bit, and I mean that sincerely, because when I was doing television, we lived in New Mexico. We weren't LA people. I wasn't a working kid actor. It kind of fell into my lap in a very exciting way, because when things fall into my lap, they're always exciting.
Papa Smurf.
Especially at 15. But then I've done things. Magic, for instance. I know a lot about magic. I was the president of the Academy of Magical Arts for 4 years in LA, so I've worked hard in magic, but I'm not a magician. I don't have 20 minutes of stuff that I can do. I love magic, but I don't really do it. Comedy, like I'm not a stand-up. I don't tell, you know, improvising, I'm just so fascinated by the brain of an improviser in creating but I feel like I'm not of their level, because I didn't study at UCB. I wasn't a groundling. Tony Awards. I've never taken a dance class in my life. So I'm there learning. And I can do some choreography, right? It's not like I'm inept at it. It's just that I'm not trained in it. So there I am in a rehearsal room with the best dancers in the country on all the shows, and they're all sha-ba-ba, ra-ba-ba-ba, got it. What? And so that feeling of needing to prove something because I wasn't a dancer, and here I am having to dance. So that's a kind of a runner in my career, I think. Well, it maybe speaks to why I do these breathing fire things, you know?
Well,
I don't know.
Listen, if that's true, then there are a lot of people benefiting from your humility and perhaps your insecurity. Listen, I don't know. But
it's like a therapy session. What happened?
It always goes down that way with me. To feel, I think that's also very normal for somebody who has a lot of different passions and then sees the person who has dedicated their entire life to one thing. The expectation wouldn't be that you would need to be that good. And again, you have admiration for those people, and you celebrate them, and you want to work with them, and you want to be surrounded by the people who are the best at what they do. So I think that's probably like a you know, a little bit of a balancing act that you might always walk,
sure.
But in a good way, in a way that keeps you humble, which I think is one of the things that makes you so well-loved, is that it's clear that you're not sort of
a
like,
dick.
Yep, you want to look for the best? Name a thing, I'm the best at it. Like, that's not you, you know?
Yeah, fair enough.
Until right now. Until you decided to take over as the best at it.
Well, no, I feel that at 45, I have done a lot of stuff. So now I can, before I would feel fraudulent doing Shakespeare because I didn't study Shakespeare. I learned it with a dramaturg, and I played Romeo in the old Globe Theater in San Diego. And it was great, but again, I just felt like I'm surrounded by Shakespearean-trained actors and I don't know how to do it. But now I've done enough things that I can be proud of the fact that my education was through immersion,
right,
and that's equally sound.
I feel like you might have even said that about joining the cast of How I Met Your Mother a little bit, which you had done television before, you had done funny television before.
Yeah.
But when that came around, was there a sense of that, of like looking around going, okay, I got to make sure I belong here and I got to make sure I show up for this?
A little bit. I felt more comfortable in television. I had done a few multi-camera things before, but not with longevity. The fun thing about that is that it was a hybrid show, so it was filmed with multiple cameras, but there wasn't a live studio audience there to see it because there were just so many flashbacky scenes. It would have been really boring for everybody. And then Barney Stinson was someone who was so crazy and delusional that it was a joy. It was just a fun thing to go to work because they would write cool bits, and it felt like a softball lob. You know, glorious professional game of softball, and I was just ready to crack it and see how far I could swing. And normally that would be trying to show off, but when you were tasked to do that as Barney, then it was an honor. You know,
bigger, better, faster, louder. If that's Barney, then you get to really play.
Yeah, and I'm glad that if that show ran 9 years, right, and it's a long run. But I'm glad that Barney got to be a cool guy, wearing suits and laser tag and coming up with name, like catchphrases. And
laser tag.
Because if you just wind up with like an Urkel catchphrase that they give you every three episodes, you have to turn to the camera, did I do that? And that's sort of the thing that you only do.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. Although, I mean, I'm pretty good at both of those catchphrases. So.
No, they're good. They're fine. But then you just... that's an easy medium for the writers to get a bit lazy and just start having you do the same thing over and over. And thankfully, Barney was not that. He was all over the place, which was fun to play.
I got to do an episode of How I Met Your Mother that would not have been possible if it weren't hybrid, because in my episode, tiny Barneys were crawling all over my body at some point, and tiny Teds were crawling over my body at
that's
some other
true.
Point.
In your boobs and stuff, I think.
I think that's very likely. We are talking about Barney.
I like talking about in your boobs.
Yeah. There he is, everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, that was true. You had to do these weird things where you had like extreme close-up of you, and you had to just sit there and blink.
Now, Janet, what you have to imagine is a tiny man crawling up your boob. Okay.
Danny DeVito?
Tinier.
I mean,
tinier.
But
really
like, still,
tinier.
Applicable. I will say that being on that set was such a joy. I'm sorry to disappoint you, but... I just felt very included, and that's not always true of television shows that have been going and going and going, and everybody kind of has their dynamic. Pam Fryman was a big part of that, just kind of bringing everybody in, and I did get that feeling from the cast that was sort of like, you're part of the family for this week, you know,
which is
not always the case.
It was a family. We were all together all the time for through deaths, through births, through marriages, breakups, all of that. So it was a nice family. And Pam Fryman was the director of every episode except maybe 7 or 8. So she directed 235 episodes or something. And she is the nicest, most
just one of the great women of television in life in general.
Yeah.
So we were all very lucky to have her. Because oftentimes TV directors are assholes.
That's correct. And she might have been the
first. For real.
She might have been the first female single cam or like a, you know, a multi-cam or a sitcom director that I had worked with.
Nice.
It's not necessarily hugely populated with women. That probably doesn't surprise anyone. But I think Pam is one of the people who really helped make it more possible for younger women to come in. And not that she's old. She's not at all. But, you know, for people to come in, follow in her footsteps. And
what are your
really
thoughts? I have a question for you. What are your thoughts on comedy on television now, on network TV? Because I feel like, I mean, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I guess it's room for a conversation because the game is changing in such an interesting way. And we're here at Sketchfest and you're tuned into comedy. And a lot of the funnier stuff now is on streaming or is on Amazon or Hulu's or Netflix's so that you can curse and you don't have to keep breaking up in the middle to talk about diapers.
Right.
I mean, it's a very strange construct.
The
multi-camera show
yeah.
is interesting because historically it was designed to like have people make jokes and stuff and then they could try and sell cigarettes. And then they would, you know, that was always a part of the fiber of it.
Right.
But now you don't really need that anymore. And so now I don't know. I don't know how long it's been since I watched a network multi-camera show. Because there's so many options.
Yeah.
Do you think that it's a dying breed? Like there's not many left, right? CBS
yeah.
has a few.
Yeah.
But even those are Big Bang Theory's on their last season, and
yeah.
and Mom is on season 8 now or something. I don't know. I just wonder if people's viewing habits #Bandersnatch are changing
right.
in a way that makes that style of comedy more archaic.
I agree. I these people didn't come to hear me discuss what I think of TV and really, but I will say that I think that audiences have become more and more savvy, and there is we've seen the fourth wall get broken. We've seen, you know, sketch combined with sort of a sitcom. We've seen so many versions of comedy that have kind of broken rules and
yes.
recrafted rules that I don't know. Like, if someone said to me, you have to create a multi-camera sitcom, I would be so scared because I don't know how to do it right anymore. That's not to say that it can't be done, but I do feel like, you know, there's you got to really be doing something.
I feel like in the immersive theatery world, like I love all of that changing structure, like my book. Maybe there's a world where there's a multi-camera show that's on a Netflix, but that plays with structure.
Right. It might have to take that. It might have to be something that, again, gets meta, because audiences are very savvy and they like to kind of be inside of something.
One Day at a Time
means.
Is on Netflix.
Yeah.
And they don't have to do commercials, so they're able to do 22 minutes straight through.
Right.
So maybe there's a cool way to do some, I don't know. I'm just thinking about future gigs, I guess. But I don't know, that may be an interesting nut to crack.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Speaking of nuts.
Back to the Smurfs. One of the other things that kind of popped into my head when you were talking about your own experience, growing up in a small town in New Mexico, it works even when you say it. It was, again, this idea of, you know, as you said, when you were casting Clara's Heart, and that it was, you know, you went to a theater camp, right? And it was pretty much quickly after that suddenly you were on this movie set away from your parents, having that experience. And that, for me, is when I've listened to you, your audiobook version of The Magic Misfits, which was really fun because there was some really neat stuff baked in there that you don't get from the experience of reading it, but also you get things from the experience of reading it, like magic tricks that are kind of built in and in there for young people to learn how they work and how to become magicians themselves. But it very much has that sense of this boy who's away from what he knew, And kind of in, you know, alone in this kind of wide-eyed way as he's experiencing these various adventures and these people that he meets and seeing real magic, whatever that, you know, happens to mean in the book. Is that something, and that's something I think you have held on to, right? Is that sort of being put into a place and
I think that's a universal trope.
Yeah.
When I was asked to write these middle grade books, I thought it was a fun opportunity to write about things that I thought were cool, like just to pass it on to younger kids. Our kids are 8, they're starting to read now in earnest, which is kind of amazing to watch, and it's fun to be able to have an option for kids to read and learn about secret codes and learn about magic, but not Wizarding World magic and dragons and things, but actual magic skills. And then I tried to make it as diverse as possible, so there's different, everyone can relate to it in some way.
Yeah.
But I think everyone feels like that's a universal feeling of being uncomfortable in a world that you're not, you know, you don't know where you fit in.
Yeah.
So, especially kids. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, that's where that came from mostly.
Absolutely. I have so many things that I want to kind of address. I know there's just so very many cards. I don't have a super flawless segue into this, but I just wanted to quickly acknowledge how much I enjoyed your performance in the film Starship Troopers.
Nice. Starship Troopers, so that was a really great time for me because that was Paul Verhoeven, the director, was willing to have television actors be in movies. So I had done Doogie for 4 years, was auditioning for feature films, but back then there was a class divide. If you were a TV actor, you weren't in movies.
You did your TV movies.
I had TV movies. I tried to combine the two and just did a TV movie a year.
I was going to do a thing where I tried to quiz you on like what
actual TV movie titles.
And then I thought, you know what? He doesn't want me to do that.
Made for real life movies paid my bills for quite a while.
Yeah, but then you got the opportunity to do Starship Troopers, which
Then Paul Verhoeven hired me because he really wanted an Aryan looking cast. And he had not seen American TV, so he didn't know the Doogie Howser-ness of it all. He just thought that I was a blonde, white guy who could do it. So all of a sudden, I got to be in this big, giant movie.
Yeah.
That didn't do very well in the box office, which is a disappointment. But
yeah, it's found its audience. And
it holds up remarkably well on the DVD.
Oh, absolutely. It's very. I mean, he just nails.
Oftentimes, you see giant, you know, computer-generated bugs and things, and it just looks awful 3 years later. For some reason, what Phil Tippett did with that was just great.
Now, I actually don't have a clip of Starship Troopers, so I was just going to see if you could just read.
Okay.
I was just going to see if you could just read. It's just the first, I think it's just the first page. Yeah, you don't have to worry about the second page. That's a different scene. But just the first page, which is when we re-meet your character, Carl, who has suddenly kind of become this voice of power within the Starship Troopers. And this is a propaganda.
And are you going to, it starts with an official voice.
Yeah.
Are you going to do that one?
I will.
Okay.
So the briefing plays.
Wait, real quick.
Mm.
Oh, are we going to read the whole thing?
Well, it's just this will be you.
Okay, and what voice do I do it?
I mean, probably whatever you think Carl would sound like.
Got it. I'm ready.
And if you're really lucky, you will get cast in this role. Okay, so this is a propaganda video.
Got it.
Every day, federal scientists are looking for new ways to kill bugs, and you can help.
To defeat the enemy, we must know the enemy. Take, for instance, your basic arachnid warrior. Minimal IQ. Armored, completely lethal. You can blow a limb off, and it's still 86% combat effective. But here's a tip. Aim for the nerve stem and put him down for good. Is that what you wanted?
That's what I wanted.
Oh, my.
I really love that He's always surprised and delighted guy. Yeah. He's surprising himself with information.
So Paul, I do six or seven takes like that, and then he'd say, just do one straight and normal. And that's the one he ended up using.
See, you wouldn't ever have known that had we not dug right into it here. I want to jump to another very, very original, very unique jump up and down. You want to do some...
You said you wanted to jump to.
God. That's on me. You're right.
You're doing improv later tonight.
So I want to go ahead and jump, jump, jump. To something that, you know, I've kind of been running around a little bit in my mind. You know, because I don't want to just have this whole conversation just sort of lie down on the stage and, you know, die. So while you recover and think about what you've done, I would love to take this opportunity. You did a... There was a writer's strike.
There was a writer's strike quite some time ago. Indeed.
And there was a question of, you know, when is this going to be resolved? All the television shows that many of us loved were on hold in support of writers who deserved more and better. And while that was happening... There was a, you know, understandable dearth of stuff coming out, and you and many, I think, of the people who were experiencing that, who were on the acting side or on the writing side or on the directing side, had this urge to still be creative and yet wanted to be supportive of the writers. So, what happened? You got a call.
That was the longest intro to Dr. Horrible.
Oh, I'm not talking about Dr. Horrible.
You're talking about the Colgate commercial I did.
Yeah, I want to go ahead and run that. Yeah.
Yes, I got a call from Joss Whedon who said there's a writer's strike and no one's working, so let's make our own content. We'll put it on the interweb and we'll make our own rules.
Let's take a little look at that.
Nice.
If we could.
Is a moral dilemma, cause at first it was weird, though I swore to eliminate the worst of the plague that devoured humanity. It's true, I was vague on the how, so how can it be that you have shown me the light?
It's a brand new day, and the sun is high. All the birds are singing that you're gonna die. How I hesitated, now I wonder why. It's a brand new day.
All the times that you beat me unconscious, I forgive. All the crimes incomplete, listen, honestly, I'll live. Mr. Cool, Mr. Right, Mr. Know-it-all is through. Now the future's so bright, and I owe it all to you. Show me the light.
It's a brand new me, I got no remorse. Now the water's rising, but I know the course. I'm gonna shock the world, gonna show that horse. It's a brand new day.
Nice. That was just great. Joss Whedon's such a special guy. You guys all know. I mean, he has a great appreciation for the fans and a wit and a kinetic sense to his dialogue and the people that he works with. And I had always wanted to be on a show of his. So he called and said, I want to do this thing, and I want you to be Dr. Horrible. In fact, I think he said... I was on the way to New York, and he called, and he said, hey, Neil, I know the writer's strike's going on, but there's this thing. And I said, yes. And he said, let me finish. There's a thing called Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog. And I said, I'll do it. He said, well, hold on. And then I got to do it. It was just great. It was filmed at the Universal Studios backlot because nothing was filming. And it was guerrilla filmmaking for sure. There were certain things we just only had the time to shoot one single take of things. And I feel like the purity of it is you can still see it. And I don't know what the X factor is with that, whether it was just fortuitous all around, but the songs are still super great, and Nathan is just so hilarious in it, and Felicia's unbelievable. Like, the whole thing was just really great start to finish. And they keep threatening to make a movie, which would be so rad.
Yeah.
But what at this point, I feel like they'll just hire Lucas Hedges.
Well,
to be in it.
We wouldn't stand for that, would we?
Really?
We need the OG cast for sure.
Yeah, the OLD cast.
The OLD cast. did you know you wanted to work with Joss? Had you met him? Had he heard that you wanted to work with him?
I had done some Shakespeare for a while when he lived in Santa Monica. He would every couple months invite friends over and just read a Shakespeare play and give people parts, and you'd rehearse them and you'd do it book in hand just to hear what it sounded like. It was really fun, and so I got to be in that world for two or three shows of that. It was just a way to hang out and feel artistic.
Sure.
In a town that's more about auditioning.
Right.
And then from that, and no, you know what? I think I was offered a part in one of his shows, Nathan's show.
Okay.
Firefly.
I've heard of it. Oh, yeah, you said that you were going to be the doctor,
the
right?
Young
you came
doctor
close.
Guy, yeah.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah, how about that? That blew someone's mind. I think.
But
I don't know what that was.
It didn't wind up happening, which is, I think I was also like, wasn't super keen about being another like doctor guy on a show.
Fair.
So I ended up with being another doctor for Joss tonight. They follow me everywhere.
Yeah, well, Firefly is another, I think that when you talk about that sort of like that, just that magic that in a bottle, right? That Dr. Horrible has.
Dr. Horrible was the first content. Yeah. It really did change streaming
online,
media.
Online, yeah.
They released it for free, one part a week, and it was so exciting because you'd sit there on your laptop and we would watch. You know, you'd see it happen, and you could see all the comments about it and see if people liked it or not. And then another week, part two would come out and people were speculating about what was going to happen. It was super fun. And then they just moved it and sold it on iTunes. But I think it was legit one of the first well-received mainstream ideas of creating content online.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Listen, I know that you've sort of said in the past that some of your musical theater background tended more towards the kind of traditional music, maybe a little less rock and roll. You mentioned, of course, you had a run on Rent, and then I saw your production of Rent that you directed at the Hollywood Bowl.
I directed Rent at the Hollywood Bowl, and Rent Live is on tonight on Fox.
And Rent Live is on tonight.
I kind of want to just hate watch it.
You're allowed.
I mean, I'm hoping it's good, but I don't know.
Let's just live, all stay here live and together and...
Those live musicals are so fun to want things to go terribly wrong.
Yeah.
Like, oh, Allison Williams, I hope that the wire breaks.
I saw you. I saw you right after one. I was in New York, and I don't remember which one had aired, but we really did sit there and just dissect every moment. Like, do you think they knew the blah, blah, blah was going to blah, blah, blah?
What I mean, it's live, so that's the whole purpose of watching it, is kind of hoping that things, how they would react if something went wrong.
Right. But you know, you've I think you've been very kind of humble about the process of signing on to do something like Hedwig, because you felt maybe that, you know, were you ready to take on that style of music and that kind of
Hedwig?
Yeah, the transformation that had to happen for you physically and just technically, right, to make that work.
Hedwig was insane because it came my way. David Binder asked if I'd be interested in doing it on Broadway, and it just brought up a lot of concerns, like intrinsic concerns within me. One being music. My music background was the Smothers Brothers and like the Kingston Trio into Billy Joel and Beach Boys in the middle of that. And
then, hot.
Yeah. And then B-52s. Like, it was not punk rock, really. I guess a little bit in the B-52s-ish. But that wasn't my world, punk music. And then femininity was an interesting challenge for me as well, because I had been playing Barney Stinson for that whole time, and to be that feminine, it was challenging. It just challenged my own innate, intrinsic kind of personal homophobia of what I thought was too gay or not gay enough, which was all very weird in my own head. And so the idea of doing something like that, and drag wearing women's clothes, was not something I had ever done. Like, that wasn't a fetish thing that I liked to do, or I'd never walked in heels before. And so all of that seemed terrifying, which was why I just had to do it.
Yeah. Good for you.
I just had to do it.
This is often true when you're doing beloved shows that get, you know, restaged over and over, but because also it's not that you're not originating a character in drag for the first, you know, for the first time, so that whatever you're bringing to it is not going to be compared to anything else. But coming to it and having something that is so beloved and had been made into a film, and
yeah,
you know, the sort of sense of the John Cameron Mitchell of it all, were you nervous about that, or did you see that as an opportunity to go, well, I'm going to be my version of, you know, this
John's
character.
was a producer in the revival as well, so
yeah.
he not only did it have his blessing, but he was part of the creative process, so that helped a lot. And I think the fact that Hedwig by design, she's very fractured and a bit of a failure and not so good at what she does. So that made it helpful. Those were great safety nets with which to play, because if I was having an off day vocally or something, it was almost better if I tried to perform it too well, then she would have been a more successful person. But Hedwig's lament is that she didn't get famous enough.
Yeah.
So in many ways, the things that freaked me out the most about it were probably the things that were more exciting to watch about
yeah.
it, right? Because, well, let's. I guess I could talk on both sides of that. But I had to get overly comfortable with walking and with mannerisms, because I didn't want the gay community, and I really didn't want the drag community to throw shade at me.
Fair.
Just because my name was recognizable enough to do a version of it on Broadway, but I hadn't really paid my dues in drag, so I felt, again, fraudulent in a way, because it might be disrespectful, and you might see my poker tells a lot, you know. So I had to I just challenged myself, and there's a fantastic drag queen named Willem Belly, and Willem, who was kicked off RuPaul's Drag Race. And he's amazing, and he taught me how to walk, and we brought, you know, I was just with Spencer Lift, the choreographer of that, and he and I and Willem, just standing, you know, it's just such a different, cocking a hip and stuff
yeah.
is just so different when
Absolutely.
You're in heels for sure,
yeah.
but just a guy, like a way I at least carried my body, I just wasn't used to that. So even just learning how to, like, it felt
yeah.
so dumb
Not
for
dumb.
So long.
Yeah.
And then, but then even when the show happened, like, this is Hedwig who has been doing, she's older. She's been through all of this already, like,
right.
for decades. So that was the hard part that I, the challenging part was trying to figure out how to quickly get over my own neuroses and get well, and have that be well behind me.
Yeah. I will just quickly say my personal experience of seeing it on Broadway was with, I think, maybe the first 10 minutes, I was just taut on the edge of my seat. So I was, like, worried for you, not in any way, because I was like, oh, is he going to be any good or his performance? I just immediately clocked how hard it is, like, the physicality of it. And the fact that you're on stage the entire time, and I knew that going in because I was a fan of the show itself, and And I just couldn't get out of my head for a couple minutes because I was like, oh my God, he's so thin. He looks so beautiful, but he's so thin and he's working so hard out there and he's going to be doing this for the whole show. And then I completely forgot it was you.
Oh, cool.
Utterly forgot. Just disappeared in the same way that you disappear into that role and had to sort of remind myself at the end of the show, like, oh, that's my friend Neil. It was
crazy.
Stunning.
I lost 30 pounds, I think. I was 131 pounds or something by the end of it. And because I didn't have any body fat, I kept trying to get sick, so I would wind up with yeast infection on your vocal cords and things.
Boy.
Because when you would drink a beer or wine or eat bread, it had nowhere to go.
Yeah.
It's very strange.
That's crazy, right? You don't think about that. That yeast would be like.
And I didn't have an understudy.
Yeah.
So I had to do all the shows.
Ay, ay, ay.
But one of the things that I wanted to do was feel like I was a punk rock star. So the masochistic element of it was part of it.
Yeah.
You know,
that makes sense.
With being grueling, but I was watching all these videos of the Sex Pistols and them being super, you know, super messed up. And I thought that energy to me was exciting. The idea that I could somehow replicate that energy at the Belasco Theater on Broadway to people who are Upper East Side biddies that are sitting there, you know. Yeah, because performing punk in a punk, in like a you go to a bar, then you're surrounded by people who want to hear that music. But I thought there was a challenge and something kind of horny about the idea of
absolutely
being Marilyn Manson or, what's his name, Nine Inch Nails?
Trent Reznor.
Yeah, Trent Reznor. So I watched Trent Reznor video where he went to, and maybe it was Marilyn Manson, but he went to the foot of the stage and he had his shirt off and he just opened up his mouth and people were just spitting in his mouth.
You guys don't have to do that right now.
I thought that was so hot.
Yeah.
Seriously, I thought it was gross. I mean, it was understandably gross. And I wasn't about to do that every night,
but
that was kind of the vibe that I wanted.
Yeah.
Is this was this reckless? When I would cut myself and my leg would be bleeding, I loved it. It was so awesome. So yeah, it was a lot of intensity.
I think thank God that you did have that relationship to it, because that's probably what also made it possible to keep going. Is to have, you know, that relationship to it where you're just embracing all of that.
I want to do it again. I almost did it this summer in London. We're trying to get it to go to London.
If I know one thing about my beloved San Francisco, it's that we know how to appreciate a good musical.
A good musical and a good drag.
So, note to selves, everyone. I want to go to an audience Q&A really soon, but are you guys, would you like to see a little bit of Hedwig just to kind of celebrate that? But why don't we take a look?
Sweet tooth for licorice drops and jelly roll. Hey, sugar daddy, Hansel needs some sugar in his bowl. I'll lay a fine china on the linen and polish up the prong. If you got some sugar for me, sugar daddy, bring it home. Blackstrap molasses, you're my orange blossom, honey bear.
Sugar daddy, sugar daddy,
bring me Versace blue jeans, black designer underwear.
Sugar daddy, sugar daddy,
let's dress up like the disco dance and jet set in my line and roll. And if you got some sugar for me, sugar daddy, bring it home.
Oh,
that was so fun.
I just had the mini version of what I said before. I just had the mini version of that. It was like the truncated version where I, you, the same thing happened. I was like, oh God, he's so thin. And then I forgot it was you again. And that, we're sitting here on stage and I called for that clip to play and I still was like,
that was fun.
Great.
You should watch the whole thing though, because I got to go into the audience and I got to do the car wash on Orlando Bloom's head. And then I went through and I sat in Sting's lap. I gave Sting a lap dance. I grinded up against his hong. And then I licked someone's glasses. Samuel L. Jackson, yeah. I licked his glasses and put him back on his
what
head.
What a satisfying person
anarchy.
To be able to do that to. Oh.
His expression, he's like.
And you were like, you're lucky I didn't spit in your mouth. Because I'm real into Trent Reznor right
that
now.
That was so fun. Maybe someday I'll get to do Hedwig again.
Well, I love the drag.
David and I produced a drag festival called Wigstock that was right. In New York. Lady Bunny, the great Lady Bunny, she's a drag staple in NYC, and she did this this drag festival in Tompkins Square Park for years and years, and it was super great. And then she stopped doing it for about 11 years. And David Burtka, the great David Burtka, said mm-hmm. when we were watching drag together on TV, he said, why don't they do Wigstock anymore? And I said, that's a very good question, why? And he said, we should revive it. And so we realized, I mean, I was so proud of it. We did it on the top of the South Street Seaport Piers, this brand new Pier 16 or something. And it was spectacular. You had views of the bridges and it was outdoor and it was 8 hours of drag from the oldest drag queen in America, in the world was there, to the youngest, to the a lot of trans people. Just and what was exciting for me, this is interesting because it's very akin to the Tonys and P.T. Barnuming, is that I wanted people to see drag performers do what they do, what makes them proudest. Because RuPaul's Drag Race is a very important show in that community, in the community, I think, because it's very popular, and people now see all these examples of representation, and I think that's great. Unfortunately, the performances that they do, they're lip-syncing for their lives because they're about to be eliminated, and it's a song that they just learned yesterday, right? And I think that while they're still great performances, unless you seek out a drag performance or a cabaret, you're not getting to see them do what they do, why they got hired in the first place. So I wanted to do this festival. HBO is making a documentary of it. They documented the whole thing. So we're in the process of editing that. But I just want to, because of having done Hedwig and dipped my foot into a bit, I just have incredible respect for people who dedicate their lives to doing that. There's a lot of hardship. There's a lot of rawness. And I think to still, like, night in, night out, be putting on your makeup in the kitchen at a side little table with not great, not getting paid well,
right,
to super drunk people all the time, is odd and demands respect. And they're super great. I mean, it's a magic trick.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But it's a life. I love it.
Oh, it's time for a quick break. I will be back after a word from our friends at Maximum Fun.
The Greatest Discovery is a podcast about Star Trek Discovery and so much more, Ben.
We watched the entire first season of Star Trek Discovery, but now we're finding all kinds of interesting ancillary topics to get into.
We're interviewing our favorite people.
Reading comic books.
And we're updating you on the news about season 2 of Star Trek Discovery.
It's news you can use, and it's every 2 weeks on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh my, there's so many question people. Better be good. We're going to judge you.
It's a thrill to be here and meet you. And
thanks, man.
Say hello. But could you talk a little bit about Gone Girl? Because that was really crazy and scary and amazing.
Yeah, Gone Girl was another one of those pinch me opportunities that David Fincher, having been on How I Met Your Mother and Barney Stinson, I think it has its own, creates its own baggage of people recognizing me as a certain energy, and that doesn't really fit into a lot of the big motion picture directors' ideas. And so Fincher just reached out and said he's doing this movie called Gone Girl, and would I have lunch with him? Which was a very nerve-wracking lunch. Because I wasn't auditioning, but I wasn't sure what he wanted, whether he wanted me to just be myself, or whether he wanted me to talk about acting, or talk shop. I had no idea. And we just talked about crossword puzzles and games and stuff like that. And I think he was actually just meeting me to see if I was a dick, like if I would slow his process down. Because I think he's less interested in spending time with actors and having them breaking down and being insecure. I think he likes technicians, but he does 40, 50 takes. I had to do this scene with Rosamund Pike where we have sex and then it ends badly for me. And we had to over-rehearse all of that and film it all in this sound stage. And so that was doing 50 takes of the scene being a sex scene, and every move has to be spontaneous but very, very, very well rehearsed. It was very crazy. He's a great guy, though.
We refrained from showing that clip, even though we kind of wanted to.
Totally.
It's going to be an easy one. Do you really have the tattoo from Count Olaf on your ankle?
I do, man. You want to see it?
And can I have a hug?
Yeah.
I mean, got to throw that one in there.
There it is, baby.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'll hug you in a sec.
Hi. Hi. Given how much we love seeing you do musicals, I'm wondering which of your previous projects that you've done would you most enjoy performing your role in a musicalized version?
Gone Girl! But it would be spelled G-O-N-E-G-U-R-L. Gone Girl!
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
My name is Noelle, and I'm an aspiring actress and screenwriter. I recently finished my first screenplay. What advice do you have for me? And if you could do the vocals for any Disneyland ride other than California Dreamin', what would you do?
I'll answer the second question first. I've always wanted to be the voice of an animatronic character.
Cool.
I've done voiceover stuff before, but I think it would be fun to just be a character, you know, like...
Great moments with Mr. Lincoln. With Neil Patrick Harris as Mr. Lincoln.
Just like the paperboy kid. Extra, extra, read all about it. Hey, mister, wanna pay? And you have to do, like, 15 minutes of it in case the ride stops. I don't know. I'd like to be the voice of a robot.
Cool.
Advice? How old are you, Noelle?
I'm 17, almost 18.
Nice.
Yeah, you already finished your first screenplay. You're way ahead of the game. That's awesome.
Play.
Thank you.
I guess my advice, having done as many weird, disparate things as I've done, would be to recognize that failure is happens way more with great frequency, and to not personalize it. I'm not sure about in the screenwriting world. But it's just really hard as an actor to keep not getting the job. But the odds are stacked against you, right? Because when you're casting, you want the casting director to get a bunch of people to audition for it, and only one person gets it. So almost everyone uniformly is not getting jobs all the time. And that's a really hard headspace to be in. It's what I think makes LA a difficult town to live in. But if you can find what you think is individual and right about yourself as an actor, and then just keep doing that, and trust that when you don't get the gigs, it doesn't have anything to do with you. I mean, be prepared. You know, do a good audition.
But when you don't get it, don't go, oh, what's wrong with me? What am I doing wrong? What am I doing? Why? Because oftentimes it's that the person before you looked like you, or the person you're playing opposite that just got cast is a different type, or their casting director's hungry, or there's just so many weird things that have nothing to do with the job. So if you're going to commit to acting, do it because you have to do it, because you love doing it, but figure out what your wheelhouse is and then stay strong within that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
Hedwig blew my mind. Just had to say that.
Warm.
And I was curious how
Hedwig blew my husband.
Awesome. How did the Lin-Manuel Miranda opening and close, how did that all come about? Because that was amazing.
That number, the It's Bigger?
Yeah.
I was asked to host the Tonys that year, but the couple years prior, it had been at the Beacon Theater in the Upper West Side, which was a movie house, smaller space, because they had Cirque du Soleil show during the summers at Radio City. And the Beacon was fun. That's where we did... Not Just for Gays Anymore, I think. And that it's a cool space, but it's very small and intimate. And there's something fun about watching Tony's there because it doesn't feel, it feels like you're a part of it. But we went back to Radio City. And so I said, well, there's your opening number. Has to be how big everything is. And I imagined it being a South Park-y kind of beer shanty kind of song, you know, it's bigger, the thing is really bigger, and then I say, and Lynn would just do fast patter, I can do fast patter teleprompter stuff pretty well, and so I thought it would be, because it's bigger, it's really, really bigger, that was kind of like my idea for it, and so Lynn said he'd do it, and before that he had done the closing number, the closing recaps, I would sort of end the show, those numbers, end the whole telecast with a wrap-up of things that had actually happened magic trick style, so that you thought, how did he even know that that was going to happen? And Lynn and Tommy Cail were backstage watching the show and coming up with lyrics on the spot, and then I would go back for the 30 minutes before that happened and learn my syncopation, get my Hamilton going, and I did that, so that was awesome, and then he agreed to do the opening number, and we just incorporated all the shows. It was insane. So many things could have gone really, really wrong, because all of those casts were only knew their little parts, and they all had to rehearse independently. There was one day where I was brought into a big rehearsal space, because it was the actual cast of all the shows that were on Broadway, so you couldn't have everyone come multiple times. And it was a big giant rehearsal space, and I was bleary already. And they said, okay, this is the cast of Pippin, and that's the cast of Step Up. And it's like, oh, hi, there's 80 of you people. Okay, so here's what's going to happen. You're going to stand here, and you're going to do this and this and this, and then you're going to jump to the hoop, and then you're going to do that, and you're going to stand here, and the guy's going to fly over you, okay? Really? Okay, how do you jump through a hoop? And I said, well, hold the hoop up. And you just jump through it. I said, seriously? There's no trick to that? And they said, no, just jump through the hoop. And sure enough, that's what you do. You're like, jump through it. And so, boom, and I jumped through the hoop. And then I had maybe 7 minutes with them. And then they were just like, okay, great, we're moving on. This is the cast of Step Up, so you're going to go from there, you're going to finish that, you're going to run over here, then they're going to pick you up, and you're like a cheerleader thing, and you're going to stand, really, right now? Okay. And then we did it, and I learned how to do this sort of cheerleader thing. Tight core, tight butt, and hold you up, and then they dropped me down, and then great. And then I would never see them again. I was like, okay, thanks. And then in comes another cast, and another cast, and I was just kind of bleary from the whole thing. And the odds of something like that, having things go wrong, was really high. The magic trick that happens, the thing never worked. Like the dress rehearsal, it failed till the end. And my first wardrobe change from once, I started off doing once, which was the winning musical from the year previous. And so I stood up there and I had that Henley shirt and the vest, and I used the guitar for a bit.
And then this song changed, and I run off stage, and I'm supposed to run off stage, and the wardrobe person's right there, and I was take off my vest, pop on a Velcro shirt, quick change, suit jacket, run back on. We rehearsed it. I didn't know that this had happened. The wardrobe never came down. So night of the show, Spencer, Liff, choreographer, is standing there backstage, and there's the cast of all these shows just lined up against the wall. There were two people on either side, and they were like, you guys hold, you guys go, 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 freeze, you, go, go, go. All this is happening backstage, so I'm doing my thing, real calm, I'm playing the guitar, and then I turn around, and the wardrobe's not there, so Spencer's like yelling, where's the fucking clothes? And they... chain of telephone, people in the cast are yelling all the way up. So Spencer's thinking, I don't know what to do, this is live, he's like about to run on, so he just takes off his own jacket. And he was very ready to just put me in his jacket and just say, he was just gonna very calmly say, your wardrobe's not here, you're wearing this jacket, it's gonna be what it's gonna be. And just send me on my way. So I didn't, I don't know, I'm just playing the thing, went well in the dress rehearsal, and then I run, and literally as the wardrobe gets into his hand as I turn around, and he then acts really calm, just puts the thing on, zip, 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 and I go, I never knew it happened. He collapsed and probably had a heart attack. But so many of those things for that number almost sunk the whole thing. But it was fun. I mean, I think, again, when you watch it, it's you could see the energy in the room. We didn't expect it to be so well-received. And it just was very well received. And there's actually a video of Glenn Weiss, who's the director. There's a video of him in the booth calling the shots at the end of the number because they applauded and stood up for like 2 minutes straight, which was an insane amount of time. And it was I was so pleased for everyone because there were people in the aisles and there were Newsies and there were Lion King puppets and there were Spider-Man and there were all these crazy people. Mike Tyson. It's just very odd. And you can just, when you watch it, you see all these cuts. But when you see Glenn and he's laughing and he's sort of like, go three, go four, back three, go five, 17, three. It's a really fun thing to watch. That makes me happy. Thanks.
Hi, Neil.
Hiya.
I had the pleasure of watching you on Broadway. And I actually have a playbill that Lena signed. And I was wondering if you could sign it too.
Sure.
For me. Thank you.
You're welcome. It's a great question. Don't mind us. Love, Jana Varney.
You're welcome.
Hi.
Hi. Speaking of Broadway, we would have never seen SpongeBob without your plug and recommendation, so thank you.
Nice.
We have an 11-year-old, so I'm curious about your best recommendation right now for the best currently running Broadway show to see with him and without him.
I want to take our kids to see My Fair Lady. Because Lauren Ambrose was in it, of 6 Feet Under fame, and she was fantastic. But now Laura Benanti is in it, and she's just great. I'm a massive Laura Benanti fan. She knows how to find comedy bits and maintain a truth, and her voice is angelic. And I think that's kind of, I like the classical shows for 11-year-olds, because you do need to honor what is not all SpongeBob.
Right.
As far as adult-only shows, I cannot recommend immersive theater enough. So if you have not seen Sleep No More at the McKittrick, it's, do you know about Sleep No More?
No.
So it's Shakespeare's Macbeth by way of David Lynch or The Twilight Zone. They've taken a hotel, or they've taken a building, or an old dance place called Twilo, and they've turned it into a 100-room hotel. 5 stories, bars, and you can just wander. Everyone who's watching the show is wearing a mask. So you're anonymous. This very kind of weird white Freudian looking kind of mask. And because of that, you can follow one person the whole time. You can stay in one room. You can open drawers. You can read letters. Sometimes they take you to individual places. But it's a different experience for everyone. And I just think structurally, it's spectacular. It's like 8.5 hours of material that's happening simultaneously in a loop. And there's no dialogue, so don't be scared about the Shakespeare. It's just the stories of that. And it's all modern interpretive dance. And the casts have changed a lot, and it's so great. It's just, it's like ether. It's really, it's a great show.
But also, don't look up any more information than that, because it's the best when you don't know what to expect. That's the best experience, I think, of it, is just letting it kind of wash over you.
Thanks, we're all in.
Had to put my two cents in, sorry.
As Julie Chen says, expect the unexpected. Julie Chen Mendez, sorry.
I'm Matt. I was 12 when your rendition of Company like first hit YouTube.
Nice.
And like growing up, sort of really isolated as like a gay trans kid, like it was just a lot of the isolation of being alive, like really spoke to me at a time when I like didn't know how to understand and verbalize a lot of what I was experiencing.
Cool.
Was that like feeling of isolation like intentional or just like sort of directed from personal experience?
That would be a Sondheim-y question for sure, because I think Bobby's journey within that show is a complicated one. It's a very strangely designed show. It was done in the 70s, and I think they were playing with anti-structure, and so Bobby keeps being put into scenes with other people, and he feels removed from them, but what he learns from them he doesn't take with him to the next scene. So as an actor, that's a hard thing, because if you sit and you have a scene and you give someone a hug and you have something's grown, then you take that with you. But in this case, you weren't supposed to, so I didn't quite get it. So I was kind of isolated in that I didn't quite understand it. And I was also very underprepared for that particular performance. It was supposed to be one of those Lincoln Center book in hand kind of staged readings of Company, and it was fully realized with all these dance numbers and everything, and I was failing. It was a near disaster for me, because I was in every scene, but I had these weird interstitial lines as Bobby. So I knew my songs because I'd learned those, but those scenes, those are the hardest ones to remember. It's better, easier to say a monologue because you're in control of it, but when two people are talking and then every once in a while you say, no kidding, that must have been crazy, then what happened? If you don't remember exactly where that goes, the whole scene stops. And I was tired and I tried a scene and I was rehearsing with every scene and I was just underwater. So I think my isolation was probably part just terror.
I mean,
but that said, it's a very interesting show, and I'm fascinated and super impressed that you had a personal connection to that version of the material. Do you know about the UK company that's happening right now?
I do not.
They've changed the gender of three or four of the characters, and Bobby's now female, and two of the straight couple. Oh, the straight couple that's getting married, and she's it's usually the woman that sings that. I'm not getting married today. That's now two guys that are getting married. So they've done some, and Patti LuPone is still in it. It's supposed to be an interesting take on sort of the gender norms that seem a little awkward when it's performed as written right now. Check it out.
Yeah, with San Junipero, they said it was really awkward until they made everything gay.
Well said.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Are we doing okay on time, Heather Gallagher? Okay, good.
Hi, Neil.
Hey, what's up?
First of all, I want to say you were awesome and Hedwig had a chance to see it.
Thanks.
I know Perfidia, the wig master, so.
Perfidia, good.
Yeah, he's great. Friend of mine.
Nice.
Just a quick question. Aspiring actor, and just wondering if you have any rituals you do before you do a scene or get on stage, because sometimes in class I know we had this topic come up, like he'll say, like, You didn't have it at the top of the scene, but towards the middle and the end, you had it. So I feel like a ritual would help.
Do you do any kind of meditation?
Yeah, I sort of have some stretches I do, but I think maybe I should probably do some vocal warm-ups or something.
Vocal warm-ups are good. Breathing is good. I have a vocal warm-up that I do that's mostly breath-related, just to like breathe into your body more. As you can probably have been observing, I tend to put a lot of stresses in my neck, and so trying to keep the breath more fluid, less rigid, is probably a good metaphor for acting in a scene. You know, I think to be loose and not too tight, it'll save you in a car wreck.
Okay.
And hopefully that won't be the scene you're doing.
True. No, it is kind of like that. It's like you go out too fast in the scene and it's like, okay, dialogue.
Yeah, I mean, everyone's, it's a, I wish I could give you a more concrete answer because, but I think actors are all, they're very different people. Some people are very technical, some people are very emotional, some people need a lot of sense memory to make it happen, and other people are bored by that and just want to be told when they're supposed to sit down. All of those are valid. So it's, the best thing you can do is be a conduit and not take things personally.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Last question.
Oh, what about you?
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I wanted to say you have a very beautiful family, and I adore all the annual Halloween photos that you guys do.
Thank you.
Who is the mastermind that creates these ideas, and which one has been your favorite?
Of Halloween costumes. Yeah, we just started doing them because when you have kids, they're kind of like stuffed animals that move when they're little. And so they're like, oh, you can be Smee, and you can be Tinkerbell. That's so cute. Well, there's four of us. We'll take a picture. And then that was done. We had to beat that the next year. So we just kept getting bigger. David's, I don't know. We talk about it a lot. I like Halloween. That's my, again, Halloween is immersive theater to me. But for the masses, you get to put on a weird costume and pretend like you're someone else for a night. And go to haunted houses where you get scared, but they're not allowed to touch you. I like that dynamic. So I think I loved the Star Wars one that we did because the kids got into it enough that they were into Star Wars. So if you look at that picture, Harper's doing the same annoyed expression that Carrie Fisher was doing. And David's doing kind of the perfect Han Solo with the gun. I got to be Obi-Wan Kenobi, and Gid was Luke. They're all pretty cool. We have a plan for next year, we think. Now the kids are talking. They have like opinions. They disagree with you on stuff. So I don't want to do that. No, but it's such a good idea. There's only three guys, one girl, so we have to figure out, there's not a ton of things you can do, but I don't want to do that. Well, here's the deal. We make them sign. We make them agree. We get them to agree. We sometimes pay them. We make them then sign a form so they can't renege on this because they tried that too. The day before, I don't want to do that. I don't want to put on that costume. No, we have to do this. You have to do it. Put the costume on. So now we say that they can wear whatever they want for actual Halloween. But we're going to do the photo, like, let us do the photo. And then you can do your thing for Halloween proper. So we'll see. You know, they seem like they're okay with that. What's your favorite one?
I would say the Star Wars.
The Star Wars one? Yeah, that was cool. I like the circus freaks. That was a cool one, too. We did actually a Hopper with the bearded lady. I think that's why she doesn't want to do them anymore. Now that I get it.
Oh, guys, I hate the last question.
What about like a speed round? Like, you have to, it has to be a super, super quick question, super quick answer, but we get through them real quick for those who are just remaining.
Can
really,
you do that?
Really quick.
Can you do that?
Let's stand up.
Can you speed round?
Let's stand
it
up. Let's get that energy going. Let's do a speed round. Make it quick. What do you got?
For set design, if there was any set that you were on that you could add one more thing to it, what would it be? Like in Barney's apartment with the hidden beds and stuff like that, if there could be anything else that you could add on to
and go.
Sets.
God. I wish that in Hedwig there had been more trapdoors and abilities for things to move around on the set.
Great question.
Best answer.
Thanks.
Next, awesome. Go.
I just want to say I've been rereading your autobiography,
Thank you.
I wanted to make sure to say Kungaloosh, because I think like that was a really important moment that we could maybe have.
Nice.
Kungaloosh.
Disney, that's awesome.
Awesome. Hey, buddy.
The Adventures Club. What's up? What's up, tall guy?
What's the next Magic Misfits book going to be about? Because I really like them.
Aw, thanks, man. The first one was about Carter. The second one was about Layla. The third one's going to be about Theo. And then the fourth will be about...
Not said. Thanks, buddy. Come on. Speed round.
What was your favorite line from Unfortunate Series of Events?
That'll do.
My favorite
line. Almost the
line.
Title.
I liked Stefano because I came up with an ism with his voice because I had popcorn and he's trying to, in a scene and he's trying to move it and everything that he said is like this and it goes popcorn and that wasn't even a written line but we all said it for the rest of the whole run of the show.
Popcorn. Awesome. Thank you. Great question. Last two.
Why am I on my knees again?
I know.
And I'm
struggling.
So my question would be, has it ever been hard for you to disconnect from like a state of mind that a character, like the search for a character has put you through?
Yes, it has actually. I think Hedwig was the most complicated in that because she was really just damaged and thought that her life was only complete when someone else would make her complete and he wouldn't. He wasn't acquiescing, so she had to find completeness within herself, and that combined with the physical grueling, I was not the happiest person to be around during that chapter.
Thank you so
much.
Yeah,
of course.
Last but not least.
Last question.
Last but not least.
You better not screw this up. She's going to screw this question. She's going to screw it up.
Okay.
Hi, my favorite TV show is How I Met Your Mother, so I'm wearing a shirt that says... It's going to be legendary.
Wait for it.
Yes, wait for it.
No, your shirt says, wait for it.
Yes. But my favorite quote of the whole TV show is, new is always better. And I want to know, what's your favorite quote throughout the whole TV show? And if you could change the ending, what would it be?
Guys, I mean, this is a union house. We got to get out of here.
So glad it was a speed round. I did like the legend, wait for it, and I hope you're lactose intolerance because the second half of that word is dairy. That was fun to say. I've always been a self-prescribed fan of the ending. I still think that the ending as written was great. I think that those that didn't like it, I totally respect what it could have been, but I think the nature of these writers in their 30s that grew up writing changed the way that they designed the show. As they aged, so did their minds. And so to have Barney realize that he and Robin were not meant to be together, I think that that's a savvy call, because that's what happens in life. People get divorced sometimes. So I recognize that some people thought that was a bummer, but I think once you know the end and all of that, you can go back and watch the show again with an even interesting, different perspective a second pass. So I wouldn't change a thing.
Guys, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you guys for sticking around. I appreciate it.
Patrick Harris, everyone.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.